Thanks, Yuda, and thanks everybody for coming. So the goal of these, at least for some of us, I mean, part of the goal is of these workshops we've been having, which this is the second, is to teach mathematicians how to understand the language of quantum field theory well enough that they can, you know, without having to go ask a physicist to be an oracle, you can just translate between such and such a quantum field theory and such an object of geometric representation theory or enumerative geometry. So in this way, the hope would be to put string theorists out of work and allow you guys to translate string dualities into mathematics directly. So the usual kind of thing.
Kevin, could you take off your mask?
Okay. Is it
Could you take off your mask if you're okay with that?
Yeah.
For the mic.
Usual kind of thing is that a supersymmetric QFT can be translated into some statement in math. And some mysterious duality will relate the supersymmetric QFT into another supersymmetric QFT. And that this statement down here will be some interesting math conjecture. This is a pattern we're all familiar with. So the hope is to try to explain something about these vertical lines, how to go from supersymmetric Q of T, how to move directly into mathematics. So the way it's going to work some supersymmetric Q of T. Well, from that, we're going to extract a twisted QFT. And I'll explain, that's the point of today's talk, is to explain what this is. And this is going to be very directly related to math. This RL is easy and direct. So today, we're going to learn about this. So for me, the reason I think, as a mathematician, it's good to learn about this. You don't really need to know about this because every single statement in physics that is related to math factors through one of these twisted theories. Is Andre skeptical? And of course, this idea of twisting goes back to Witten, and there was work in the 90s on a more general notion of twisting by Johansson and Nekrasov. And this is kind of more general notion of twisting that we're going to be considering today. So the first thing I want to discuss is some reminders about supersymmetry. We're going to be considering 3D n equals 2 theories. So I need to remind you guys a little bit about the representation theory of the group spin 3. So spin 3C is equal to SL2C. This has a two-dimensional spin representation. S. Now, since we're going to be working in, you might be worried that I've complexified everything. This is a feat essentially because we're working in Euclidean signature. So the vector representation is C3, the symmetric square of S. So I'm going to choose a basis. So supersymmetry is going to mean that the action of translation will be extended by into a superalgebra whose fermionic part will be built from S. So in a 3D QFT, we have an infinitesimal action of C3, and because it's infinitesimal, so the level of Lie algebras, it's okay that it's complex. I just take a vector field and multiply it by I. And these are given by things like d by dx, alpha, beta. So in the supersymmetric theory, with n equals 2 supersymmetry, this is extended to an action of fermionic part will have two copies of this spin representation. And the elements here, I'll call them Q alpha or runs from 1 to 2 as well. And we have certain commutation relations, which are the following. So everything here is extremely trivial. I'm just writing down the supersymmetry algebra. So the point of twisting is going to be that we'll choose some element whose square is 0 and use that to turn the theory into a simpler theory. So we're going to take, I'm going to call it, take the element Q11 in the algebra. And then Q squared, which is half of Q brackets Q, is equal to 0. And twisting replace, what twisting does is replaces everything in the QFT by it's Q comma V. So what do I mean by that? Well, a lot of the data of a quantum field theory is linear data, like some vector spaces. So for example, if H is the Hilbert space of the QFT, then the cohomology of H with respect to Q is the Hilbert space of the twisted theory. And similarly, for something like the local operators. Okay, so the goal today is to explain how to compute these things, these Hilbert spaces and spaces of local operators of the twisted theory. And we're going to see that they're they lead naturally to familiar things from geometric representation theory. But are there any questions? Yeah. Symmetric tensor and alpha beta. Sorry, this is like a kind of Penrose notation.
So for questions, we'll try to pass these funny mics around.
So the question was, the notation with x alpha beta was confusing because it appears as four coordinates, but the point is it's symmetric alpha beta. Okay, any other questions?
So what is exactly Q? What is exactly Q? I can't really read the notation. I don't understand the notation.
So I have a tensor with two indices, one upper, one lower, and I'm just choosing those values of these indices, one and one. Well, it turns out in this case, this equation, Q squared equals zero, I mean, all solutions of this equation are related by symmetries. So if I change, you know, the upper indices, that transforms under the Lorentz group. And if I change the lower indices, that transforms under Orr symmetry. If it was in a more complicated theory, like 3n equals 4, the twists that we get would absolutely depend on the Q, and I would get different things. Any other questions? Okay. So the next thing to discuss is like, what kind of thing is the twisted theory? So what I want to answer that more precisely is how do local operators in the twisted theory behave? Let's see. So if I take, because Q is a symmetry of the original theory, there's a standard formal argument that implies that correlation functions descend to the Q cohomology. So correlation functions of Q closed operators. If I have a bunch of Q-closed operators, their correlation functions only depend on the cohomology classes. So if O1, ON are in the cohomology of local operators, we can look at the correlation functions. And we can ask, what kind of functions of X are these? So in Witten's original paper about topological twistings of 4D n equals 2 theories, he explained that in that case, the correlation functions don't depend on the position. Here, however, we don't have something quite so strong. They do depend on the position, but only on some of the coordinates. Now, we notice we've chosen our Q VQ11. Our commutation relations tell us that Q alpha 2 is d by dx 1 alpha. The vector fields these guys are Q exact. So there's two of them, namely d by dx 1, 1 and d by dx 1, 2. So to understand these a little bit better, you know, in more familiar coordinates, we notice that this vector field here is null. So it's not real in Euclidean signature. This one is real. It has some it has a length, but this one is null. So that means we can choose new coordinates. T, Z, Z bar, where Z is a complex, you know, Z is X plus I, Y. These are coordinates on R3. So that d by dx 1, 1 is d by dz bar, and d by dx 1, 2 is d by dt. Okay. So the reason I want to do this is simple formal arguments will tell us that correlation functions are independent of these coordinates because they're Q exact. So for example, if I look at the correlation functions O1, T1, C1, ON, TN, ZN, well, this is killed by d by dt1, this is equal to 0, and d by dz bar, ti, I of the same thing, is equal to 0, because we bring it inside the bracket, for example, d by dt1, O1, is equal to, so I'll just write this out very quickly, I'm sure it's very familiar to many people, Q22. And that is because this is killed by this operator is killed by Q. And finally, I can move this Q over here, and it kills all the other operators. I don't know if you can actually see this. So this is just the same argument that was in Witten's classic paper. Okay, so what have we learned? I'm going a little too slow. We've learned that on queue cohomology, correlation functions are, well, they behave as topological things in one direction, and they're holomorphic in ZZ bar. So this is a holomorphic topological theory. Okay. So the next thing we'd like to understand is what exactly are these operators? So any questions? So, to give a Lagrangian 3D n equals 2 theory, you need the following data, a group. So in this talk, I'm normally going to write G for the complex group. So this would be a compact group, a representation. Or of G, a G invariant function and Chern-Simons level. So what I'm going to try to explain is how to take this data and write down a Lagrangian for the twisted theory. But I'll start with the simplest case, which is pure gauge theory. So, to start, the representation will be zero, so it's pure gauge. In this case, fields of the twisted theory are a gauge field but which does not contain the DZ component. though it's a one form, modulo the subspace spanned by dz. So this means it has two components. Well, this is a very reasonable thing to do on in this kind of context, because this means we have parallel transport in the t and z bar directions, or at least we can take covariant derivatives in those directions, and those are exactly the directions which behave topologically. And there's also d, which is in dz times omega 0, 4 times c tensor g. And the Lagrangian is very simply integral d f a plus, in Simon's level, and I'm not going to be very careful about critical shifts here, times the integral a del a. And we will not normally consider, for the beginning of this talk, not consider this so much today. So we'll normally take k equals 0. So people might have seen this before. This Lagrangian appears in the work of Gaiotto and Witten about analytic geometric Langlands. So there, their work, one side of the analytic Langlands correspondence is you take this Lagrangian and you glue it to its complex conjugate. And then they're studying that 3D theory.
Do you want to put B and G dual rather than G so that you don't need to talk about a trace?
Okay.
Or add a trace.
I mean, okay. Yeah, that's better. So let's ignore, as I said, the Chern-Simons level for the moment. Let's take k equals 0. So what are the equations of motion? Well, if we vary b, we find that f t z bar a equals 0. And similarly, you vary A, you find that Z wedge. So here, hope you already have it. So the first equation says, well, if these were two real directions, you would say, oh, look, it's a connection which only does parallel transport in two directions and whose curvature vanishes. And then we'd say, for B, it's just covariant constant. But you might be confused if we're thinking in Euclidean signature, where this is not a real coordinate. Like, what does this equation mean? So let's unpack this equation a little bit. Well, so let's write our manifold. We think of it as a t equals 0, I have a copy of c. So at each time slice, a restricted to c times t defines a holomorphic bundle. So that doesn't use this equation at all, because in one complex dimension, there's no integrability condition for finding a holomorphic bundle. But this equation does tell us something interesting. So if we parallel transport from t equals t0 to t equals t1 using a t, then the equation 1 tells us that this is an isomorphism of holomorphic bundles. So let me say this really, like, kind of expand on this really quickly. It's very simple. For example, if G is GLN, and I'm going to take psi in the vector representation, suppose that this was holomorphic at some value of t, and then we define psi z t by parallel transport. Then this is still zero because, you know, it's zero in my initial value, and then if we differentiate it, we'll find using that equation that it's still zero. Yes, thank you. This is stupidly elementary, but I find myself slightly confused. Yeah. So that's zero by the equation. We just look in pure gauge, forget about the Chern-Simons level, we see the key data is family of holomorphic bundles, one for each time, or parallel transport is an isomorphism of holomorphic bundles. This one here? Yes, thank you. So let me quickly say what happens when we introduce matter. It's going to be some very similar story. So I'm also going to simplify it for today. Part of the data was a G-invariant function on your representation, and I'm going to call the superpotential, and I'm going to assume it's zero just for simplicity. So if I have matter, then the fields of the twisted theory are by, which is a zero form, coefficients of my representation, and eta, which is a one form, modulo dz, with coefficients in the dual of the representation. And the Lagrangian is very similar. So we notice, get this right. No, sorry, I wrote this one wrong. The way I'm writing it, it's the subspace of omega 2 of spanned by dz. So eta has two components. The t component and the z bar component. So the Lagrangian is the same. The only funny thing is that although this is just matter, it has a gauge symmetry. This should be covering a little bit of. Where eta gets sent to eta plus dA chi, and chi is in dz times zero forms. And it's easy to see, actually using the equations of motion for A, that this is a gauge symmetry of this Lagrangian. Now, as we go on, there's a very slick way of packaging all the fields and anti-fields and everything into some complex. And I want to introduce that at some stage because I think it's going to be important, useful for the later lectures. But we've had a lot of kind of formalism so far and not so much content. So I wanted to move on to seeing to explaining how you can see things like the Affine-Grassmannian appearing if you study these theories. Before that, are there any questions? Yeah.
Obvious if I take r equals to zero, that I recover the first theory you wrote down?
I forgot to write down the Lagrangian for the gauge. I was kind of the Lagrangian is the gauge part plus this.
Ah, okay.
And then plus the Chern-Simons level.
Thanks.
If you want that term too. Yeah.
Wait for the mic. So how do we recover the last example? We take R to be G, like the algebra with the adjoint action?
Oh, yeah. So yeah. So the case of pure gauge theory, you're asking if you can get pure gauge theory by thinking about pure matter?
I guess that I'm confused about the statement that you started with saying that we take R to be zero.
Right. So if the representation is zero, then these fields just aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have pure gauge theory, which is this little orange in here.
Ah, I see.
And now I am considering the case of gauge theory with matter. But I've taken the superpotential to be zero. The superpotential will be another term in the Lagrangian, but it's a little tricky to write down without introducing the antifields.
Yeah, thanks. This clears everything.
Sorry, clearly I was not presenting very clearly.
Excuse me, can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
So you said that a parallel transport gives you a isomorphism of bundles on the complex slices. If we compactify the time direction to S1, does it go back to identity itself, or will it have monodromy?
No, if you compactify, you have monodromy. So the effectively be a theory in two dimensions, and the A part would give you a holomorphic bundle on your Riemann surface with an isomorphism, like with an automorphism from monodromy around that circle, kind of like a Higgs field, but multiplicative.
I see. Can I ask you then how you read off this monodromy just from the data you wrote down?
Well, it's the path ordered exponential of AT along that circle. Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so if not, let's move on and try to understand, say, Hilbert spaces and local operators. So here's some general kind of, I don't know, classical field theory, quantum field theory yoga. I suspect it's due to Arnold from his book on classical mechanics. In any classical field theory, in dimension D, and if we take, if M is a closed D minus one manifold, then the space of solutions to the equations of motion on M cross a small interval, well, not solutions, rather germs of, is a symplectic manifold. Call this equations of motion of M. Now, typically, this will be infinite dimensional. And we have to, of course, you know, treat gauge symmetry properly and so on. And the yoga is that the Hilbert space is obtained by carefully performing geometric quantization. So we're going to apply this yoga to understand some Hilbert spaces of our 3D theories. I say the word carefully because if we were in finite dimensions, if this was quantum mechanics, then there's a Stone von Neumann theorem that tells you it doesn't really matter which polarization you choose to do geometric quantization. But in infinite dimensions, that's just not true. And if you choose the wrong polarization, you end up with the Hilbert space where the entire spectrum is negative, and that's bad. So you have to choose your polarization carefully to have a positive spectrum of the Hamiltonian. So I want to do this to understand local operators. The space of local operators, well, that's a Hilbert space on the two-sphere. But the job we're going to find some, we're going to do something a little bit easier. I'm going to go into a slight ask an apparently more complicated question, but we'll have an easier answer. We want to understand local operators on the boundary. With the boundary condition that A is equal to zero. So this is called Dirichlet boundary conditions for the gauge field. And we're going to, for now, consider the case of no matter. So how do we do this? Well, this is going to be the Hilbert space on the disk. This is the boundary, it's here. We're going to imagine a disk ending on the boundary. Okay, so what we have to do is apply this general quantum field theory yoga of geometric quantization to figure out this space of solutions to the equations of motion, which I forgot to mention is called the phase space. So we're going to figure out the phase space, and we'll find that the phase space is the cotangent bundle of the Afanasian-Grassmannian. And that will be the connection between these theories and geometric representation theory. We draw a picture. So this is t equals zero. We're on C cross the positive reals, and we're setting A equals zero at t equals zero. So we want to study the space of solutions to the equations of motion on a disk ending on the boundary. So things might get a little bit funny if your disk kind of wiggles in time. So we're going to draw it in such a way that it's kind of rectangular. So we're going to take a disk which looks like it starts life as a circle on the boundary, and it goes off in time. And at the top, it's filled in by a disk. So this is topologically a disk. This looks like the set Z equals 1 and t is between 0 and 1. Union is at less or equal to 1, t equals 1. So our task is to study the space of solutions to the equations of motion on this space. So let's first look at the A field. So at E equals 1, we have a holomorphic bundle on the disk. At T equals 0, we have a trivial bundle on the boundary of the disk. When t goes from 0 to 1, well, we already saw that parallel transport gives an isomorphism of bundles. So we have an isomorphism between these. So in other words, we get a G bundle on the disk which is trivialized on the boundary of the disk. So if you're familiar with the Afanasy-Grassmannian and you squint at this, you'll realize, yes, this is basically the Afanasy-Grassmannian. But whether it's the analytic version of the Afanasy-Grassmannian studied in Graham and Presley Siegel's book on loop groups. So this, since every G bundle on the disk is trivial, we can write this as the loop group of G modulo boundary values of holomorphic maps. But if we want really local operators, we should take D very small, in which case we replace holomorphic maps from D to G gets replaced by just the Taylor expansion. And the loop groups of G gets replaced by a Laurent expansion. And then this becomes this quotient of the Laurent series part divided by the Taylor series, which is the Afanasy-Grassmannian. Okay, so I haven't said what the B part is. Let me quickly say what the B part is and then maybe pause for questions. So, and maybe I should point out that you should bear in mind that there's lots of subtleties about this geometric quantization procedure. So it's not really a theorem that we're going to see be something built from the Afogastmanian. It's just we're just applying this well-known heuristic. So what does the B part do? Well, this has no boundary conditions. There's no constraints in the boundary. So B is dz. It's an element of dz times holomorphic maps from d to the dual. That is, you know, if I assumed that A was trivial, B would look like this. Otherwise, I should replace the dual by the associated bundle for the coadjoint representation. Section of G star of the canonical bundle tensor. The associated bundle for D star. So if you think about this, B is an element of the cotangent bundle of the Afogastmanian. The element of the cotangent fiber above whatever bundle we started with encoded by A. To see this clearly, let's look at the tangent space at the origin. So the tangent space, the origin of the Afogastmanian, well, the Afogastmanian is, you know, loops modulo positive loops. So if I'm just at the origin, it's just going to be the purely negative loops. And that's clearly dual to what the space B lives in using the residue pairing. Okay, so in sum, we find that the phase space is the cotangent model of the Afogastmanian. The reason I went through this in such detail is that the same pattern persists in many different contexts. So we know from Kapustin, you know, we know from geometric Langevin's that sheaves on the Afogastmanian are supposed to make an appearance. And we know from Kapustin-Witten they should make an appearance in 4D n equals 4 theory. If you do a similar thing, you can derive that. Okay, are there any questions? Yes.
And repeat the question.
So he was asking, how did I arrive at this equation here? I started with G bundles on the disk trivialized at the boundary, and I'm rewriting it as the loop group modulo those loops which extend to holomorphic maps. The reason is every bundle on the disk is trivial, but it has gauge symmetry. And this is the gauge symmetry. So the trivialization on the boundary, if I have a bundle on the disk, I trivialize it in the bulk, then the trivialization on the boundary is an element of the loop group, because it's a section, but I'm left with the gauge transformations in the bulk, which is that. Okay, any other questions? Yeah, Davide's question. Yes. Thanks for clarifying. Yes, I should have Davide is asking, is this a complexified phase space? And I should have mentioned, in the usual story that one will learn in like Arnold's book, we're going to do geometric quantization as a real symplectic manifold and look at real functions on the base of a polarization. But here, we're always going to be looking at everything is, you know, analytically continuous. So this is the complexified phase space. And when we try to build a Hilbert space, we're going to look at holomorphic functions on the base, or holomorphic distributions, or something like that. Chido, when should I stop, or what's the?
You've got another half hour.
That seems a bit intense. Yeah. Maybe I won't use all of that. Okay, so good. So, how do we quantize this? I won't go into too much detail here because it's a bit technical. At a first pass, we might look at holomorphic functions on the Athel-Grassmannian. Okay. This is a tricky thing because it's a big infinite dimensional manifold. But there are techniques to talk about this kind of thing. Unfortunately, this is incorrect. So the tangent space to the Athel-Grassmannian looks like this, Z inverse G, Z inverse. So holomorphic functions looks like symmetric algebra of the dual of this. So in the physics terminology, Z inverse has spin one. So if we do this, since we're dualizing, we end up with a huge tower of things of the wrong spin, sort of like the wrong dimension under the Hamiltonian of radial quantization. So if you like, you know, under radial quantization, we get a bunch of states of negative energy. So this is why one has to be careful with infinite dimensional geometric quantization. The right answer is to do something like holomorphic distributions. So more or less, holomorphic functions, maybe roughly dualized. And this is great because there's a theorem, an old theorem of Kumar, is that if we twist by a line model, and this is the vacuum module for the cosmic. And that's kind of, you know, what you would expect by thinking about the physics. So we, you know, use our intuition about geometric quantization, and it's a nice result from the late 80s, I think, in geometric representation theory. And we found the boundary local operators, once I include the Chern-Simons level, I'm being a bit quick here, are the vacuum module for the Cass MIDI, and that's kind of what you would expect. Okay. So now let me explain a little bit about the bulk story.
Kevin, can I ask a bit?
Yeah, sure.
What are the rules for geometric quantization in this twisted setting? How do you know that you're supposed to take holomorphic functions and not like L2 functions or some other kind of cohomology?
What was the first thing to?
Yeah, how do you know how to quantize in a twisted setting?
Well, I'd say, I mean, to quantize in a twisted setting is the same as to quantize in any other setting, and so one can accept that we're, as Davide pointed out, we're really looking at holomorphic objects rather than smooth objects. But I'm not sure that question is a great answer because even in finite dimensions with a symplectic manifold, geometric quantization is kind of plagued by ambiguities and dependence of polarization. And in infinite dimensions, the situation is even worse. What saves us is that 90% of the time, our spaces are cotangent bundles. So I would say we don't really. I mean, it's a little bit seat of the pants where we have some heuristic and then we choose a polarization which seems natural. Take care to assume that our Hamiltonian is positive energy, and then we get the right answer in practice.
I mean, one thing I would like to clarify, so, you know, like when I learned about geometric quantization, they told me that on your symplectic manifold, you either choose a compatible complex structure or you write it as cotangent bundle of something and you look at L2 on the base. But it kind of seems like maybe you did both of those.
Right. So if you take, let's try to think about what you just said in a holomorphic context where you've tensored everything with C.
Mm.
So now, a complex structure is a foliation, but it's a foliation which happens to point in the imaginary directions.
Mm-hmm.
So once I've tensored with C, it's just a foliation. So those two things now become the same. Your complex structure is a foliation by Lagrangian submanifolds, and so is your real polarization. So there, in the complex setting, there is only one thing to do. You take your holomorphic symplectic manifold and you foliate it over some base.
Okay.
I think Davide.
So perhaps if I can add a comment. Huh? So you mentioned in the beginning that this BF theory also appears in N=4 super Mill setup.
In your work with Edward.
And in that context, N=4 super Mill is precisely playing the role of instruct, you know, providing different recipes for quantization of this 3D equal to Lagrangian. I think with a little bit of extra work, one could try to address these questions in this four-dimensional setup, where certain choices of other things you do in four dimensions might give you different quantizations, and then one can try to figure out which one is the right one for the actual 3D physical theory.
Yeah, so you're saying, I mean, there's this story where the Hilbert space of the 4D theory might contain all of these subtleties about choice of contour or something, or choice of...
I think so. I've been thinking about it a bit.
That makes sense.
I just wanted to kind of add, since this was at least my understanding of what Kevin said, but I feel like he didn't quite say it out loud, is the reason that sort of there's both holomorphic and you're cutting down to a base is that sort of the original operators that you're trying to quantize are the holomorphic things on the cotangent bundle.
Yes.
And you're trying to find a holomorphic Hilbert space that the quantization of those act on. And so that's why you cut down to the base.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Daniel. Yeah.
So the, I guess where my initial question was coming from, the way I would have tried to think about this was to reduce to a twisted quantum mechanics. And I would get a B-type quantum mechanics whose target is the affine Grassmannian. I know what to do there because of some physical analysis that was done long ago. I'm supposed to take double, roughly double cohomology of the target to produce a Hilbert space. So the reason I was asking is because you're doing something slightly different in a you're thinking about this differently, and I wanted to expand on that, but it would maybe be nice to do it in further discussions.
Yeah, no, thanks, Jude. I mean, you're making a good point that, like, you know, when you try to quantize something on a sphere, the nice thing about a sphere is that the sphere is a boundary of a ball, and then that means that your phase space contains a canonically defined Lagrangian, and that can help you pick the correct structures. So Tudor is saying that he kind of want to look at something, a foliation, where that Lagrangian projects onto the base in a nice way. And that constrains you. Does that sound right? Yeah. Okay, well, thanks everybody. Let's see. Okay, so let's move on to the next little piece of geometry. The next piece of geometry will be to discuss, I won't take too long, what happens in the bulk. And if we look at the bulk, and we do the same thing, but include matter, we're going to find a space that was introduced by Bezukhovnik, Sasha, what was I saying? Braverman, Finkelberg, and Nakajima. They introduced this space to define the Coulomb branch of 3D gauge theories. Which makes sense because the Coulomb branch is built from local operators, and we'll be trying to get local operators. And I'm going to assume here that there's matter in some representation or. So what do we have? So I wanted to look at local operators . This is the Hilbert space S2 . I don't want to just draw an actual round S2 because that doesn't really behave so nicely with respect to the holomorphic topological structure, so I'll draw a cylinder. And there's some stuff removed in the middle. I'm going to think of it just as a point removed. Because I'm looking at germs, it doesn't really matter how big it is. So the phase space . If you look at the A field, the disk on the left, look at the A field, what does it define? It's a holomorphic bundle on the left disk on the right disk. And we can parallel transport between them along the boundary of the disk. And I'm going to make a slight simplification. It's kind of the same issue we had before about holomorphic versus Laurent series or Taylor series. And there's going to be an isomorphism between these two bundles on the band of the disk. So the simplification is I'm going to assume that, everything is actually algebraic. So I assume that the isomorphism is on the punctured disk. With some kind of finite order of poles. So similarly, for the matter, we have phi left, a section, homomorphic section, the associated Ohr bundle on the left disk, and similarly phi right, same thing, on the right disk. Now the fact that your matter must extend across this whole thing means that when I do parallel transport between the boundaries of the left and right disks, they are the same. So phi left is equal to phi right on the puncture disk. Once we have used the isomorphism between the bundles on the puncture disks. Okay, so I'm not saying, I think I'm making out this side to be a little more complicated than it really is. So this data, well, if I trivialize the G bundle on one side, on the left disk, and then this data is the BFN space of triples that appears in their paper. On the Coulomb branch. So ultimately, we find that the phase space is the cotangent bundle to the space of EFN triples. But then I need to remember that I've trivialized something, so we need to undo that. So I need to divide out by the gauge symmetry acting on the left. So I hope this makes clear why I did the one in boundary first, because this is a little more involved. So if you haven't seen this BFN space of triples, you might not find this super helpful. But the punchline is, in the case of n equals 3, n equals 4, with an appropriate topological twist, these rules we've been sketching out about geometric quantization tell you to take homology of space of BFN triples mod g of z. And now this is exactly what they did in this their papers. And this gives you the correct. Definition of the Coulomb push. Okay, so the reason for mentioning this is that I want to try to convince you that these kind of rules are heuristics. They pretty consistently lead you onto the right thing, which you can then try to, you know, if you were clever enough and BFN didn't come along, you could have just derived this. That didn't happen, but similarly, if you were clever enough and, you know, Drinfeld never said to study D modules in the Affengross-Manion, you could, in principle, have applied these rules and come to think that, well, that's think that that's the right thing to study in 4D=4-gauge theory. But the nice thing is there's many examples which have not been studied by geometric representation theory, and this formalism kind of tells you the right thing to do. It doesn't prove any theorems, but it tells you what the right thing to do is and might allow you to generate some conjectures. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thank you very much for your patience.
So at the very end here, you know, there's this switch from n equals 2 to n equals 4. And it's sort of what you're saying that n equals 2 tells you to consider this particular phase space. And what changes when you go to n equals 4 is what you should do to the phase space to get the information out of it?
Yeah, that's one way to think about it. You could also think that in n equals 4, I was a little fast at the end, and suppose I was to do all this procedure to the n equals 2 twist of n equals 4.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would have found this phase space, but with some kind of fermionic partners. So there'd be a cotangent bundle of a shifted tangent bundle or something like that. And then when I quantized, instead of finding functions, I'd be taking, you know, Dolbeau homology with, you know, differential forms, and then the further twist would replace that by something like Durand homology. That would be the more careful way to say it.
I see.
So I was doing this in 4D. Before the n equals 2, I'd find coherent sheaves on the Affengross-Manion. And before the n equals 4, it would be coherent sheaves on the Dolbeau stack of the Affengross-Manion, which deforms to D modules. That's the kind of heuristic.
Great.
Maybe I didn't understand what you said at the end there, but
I'm not sure. I'm a little tired.
If I take Dolbeau cohomology instead of Durand cohomology of this space, that's the algebra of functions on what?
Oh, so that's a really interesting thing. Right? So the n equals 4 theory has an n equals 2 twist, which knows about both Higgs and Coulomb branches. So this will be some huge thing which contains inside of it something about jets of maps from a disk to the Coulomb branch and jets of maps from a disk to the Higgs branch.
Has anybody studied that that thing?
Yes, I forgot to mention there's a paper by Kei Zeng on the archive, and it's just kind of exponentially harder to do Dolbeau versions, but he studied in the case when g is u1 with certain matter. He mostly focused on n equals 2 theories. I can't remember if he did n equals 4 as well.
Hi, regarding the Chern-Simons level, if I remember correctly, it enters in like the power of the line bundle that you take.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
How does that work with this like intuition for like local operators?
Right. So what you find in the presence of the Chern-Simons level, you find the phase space is not a cotangent bundle; it's a twisted cotangent bundle. So that means mean, do you know what that, is?
No.
Okay. So that means it's locally the cotangent bundle, but like on different patches, it's glued together by the first term class, which is now out of H11. So that's, you know, the data you need to do shifts on the cotangent fibers. Part of the geometric quantization yoga, which is present in the Borel-Weil-Both theorem, for instance, is that when you quantize a shifted cotangent bundle, you find sections of the line bundle you've used to shift. They're not shifted, twisted. And the Chern-Simons level tells you which twisted cotangent bundle is and therefore tells you which line bundle.
So, what's known about the quantization of the space phase space of bulk local operators?
What's known about it?
Yeah. Has it been studied?
In n equals 2?
Yeah, just, yeah.
Yeah, so I think the only paper about it is this, Davide and Tudor, we looked at the boundary,
mm-hmm.
and life became a lot easier when you didn't have to deal with boundary monopoles.
Mm-hmm.
So, if your gauge multiplier had Neumann boundary conditions, we could do lots. When I had Dirichlet, we could do something. And in the bulk, there's this paper of Kei Yu Zheng. It's just hard. Like he studied it with U1 with certain matter. He was able to write down the index. And it's actually, there's some really nice things. There's some kind of very, in papers of Tudor, there's like very subtle shifts in the fugacities. And they're explained very nicely by studying this Hilbert space.
But so the theorem you mentioned of Kumar said that the boundary operators are some vacuum module of some Kac-Moody mm-hmm. algebra. Is it even expected what sort of mathematical object you'll get?
For 3D n equals?
Yeah, for 3D, the case you mentioned, which is...
Yeah, in the bulk, it's just, people would call it like an E1 chiral algebra.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can do associative multiplication in the time direction, a vertex algebra multiplication in the space direction. But if you shift in time a little bit, you see that the OPEs are all non-singular. So that everything is kind of encoded in, putting one operator here, descending something and integrating it around a two-sphere. So it can be encoded in something like a Poisson vertex algebra, like in this paper of Oyagi. Probably better to study the category of line defects and interfaces between them. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of structure that's called in the math literature a chiral category. It's like a categorified vertex algebra. It was studied in, for instance, work of Hilburn and Raskin in a similar context.
Thanks.
So I hope I didn't miss this being asked, but there's a question in the chat on Zoom, which is, could you explain a bit what does it mean geometrically to do the twisting by a line bundle?
Uh-huh. It means geometrically. Oh, well, I think that the answer to that would be the same answer I gave a minute ago, that you replace the cotangent. I mean, when you have a Chern-Simons level, the equations are no longer that you're in the cotangent bundle of the Aspergras-Manion, but that you're in a twisted cotangent bundle. So that means locally it's in the cotangent bundle, but the cotangent fibers are glued together in some interesting way, determined by the first term class of the line bundle.
Was there another question online? If you'd like, please unmute yourself and go ahead and ask.
I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. I understand that the Fine-Grass-Manion also appears in the geometric Langlands correspondence realization in Fourier equals 4 theory in terms of the space of Hacker modifications associated with an Toft operator.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you mentioned earlier that you can explicitly show the relation between the construction you prescribed here and Fourier equals 4 theory with geometric Langlands twist. And how does that, how can that be shown exactly?
Okay. I think I should probably point to some papers. Justin, or what are the papers looking for this? Okay, but you look at papers by Phil Sang-Yu and Chris Elliott. But the simpler thing to do is just, so if we'll get 40 n equals 2. And I think this is probably going to be discussed in Justin's talk, will you? Or not so much, our tutor's talk. Well,
I'll take request.
If we look at OR 2 times C, and then we take a line on OR times 0, well, we do the same thing. We look at the link of the line, the equations of motion on the link, describe the shifted cotangent bundle to the affine Grassmannian modulo G. So there's a shifted version in this kind of hierosymplectic story. There's a shifted version of geometric quantization which produces categories instead of vector spaces, which was developed by Pavel Safonov. When you apply those ideas, you should get something like G of O with varying coherent sheaves on the affine Grassmannian. And this is the right answer. This is the right paper. The papers of Harold Williams with Slavin Kotas about this kind of thing. And they find something really quite close to this. If I had n equals 4, there would be some kind of fermionic stuff around. And you would end up with coherent sheaves on what's called the Dalbo stack, pass length space of the tangent bundle quotient. And that's really close to D modules. Like, it deforms to D modules. And the idea is that the extra supercharge that turns you from the holomorphic topological twist studied by Kapustin into the actual topological twist does that deformation from, you know, from Higgs bundles to D modules. So that's roughly how it's supposed to go.
Are there any other questions online? And in here? All right. Well, let's thank Kevin again.